Today's critique looks at a transdisciplinary academic white paper proposing life-coherent generative drift as a framework prioritizing redundancy and human coordination over scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
So a key theme running through this material seems to be the way systems use excess capacity to evolve.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the structural analogy linking biological redundancy to the human emotional domain of love carries a really heavy theoretical burden. It requires more explicit grounding to prevent it from reading as, you know, a poetic leap rather than a functional mechanism.
Right, which is actually a fascinating vulnerability in what is otherwise like a massively ambitious synthesis.
Oh, totally.
I mean, the paper explicitly warns us early on that taking analogies across completely different domains, say like molecular evolution and human sociology, is dangerous.
Right.
And they say these analogies can't just substitute for hard empirical mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the current weakness is that the transition from Kauffman and Deakin's concept of inverse Darwinism...
The biological side.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. The transition from that to Humberto Maturana's sociology-based biology of love relies almost entirely on formal resonance.
Right. The argument just sort of jumps.
It really does. It jumps from the physical reality of a duplicating gene masking a deadly mutation straight over to this idea that love protects legitimate belonging.
Without showing the steps in between.
Exactly. It leaves out the intermediary cognitive or sociological mechanisms that prove these two very different phenomena operate under the same physical or informational laws.
So the actionable suggestion here to improve the material is to fortify this transition, right, by mapping the exact sociological mechanisms that act as the functional equivalent of molecular buffering.
Yes. The author needs to demonstrate exactly how structural redundancy practically generates emotional safety.
Right, because focusing intensely on the how rescues the concept from just being a nice sentiment.
Yeah.
Like, how does a social structure actually mirror a duplicated gene in a way we can observe?
Well, to ground this, the author could introduce a short section detailing how overlapping social roles practically distribute risk.
Give me an example.
Okay. Consider a small community managing a vital resource, like a water supply.
Okay.
If only one person holds the knowledge of how to operate the purification system, the emotional matrix of that group is entirely governed by fear.
Because if they get sick?
Systemic collapse. Exactly. But if three people share that exact same operational knowledge, that is the sociological equivalent of gene duplication.
Oh, wow, I see.
That structural redundancy practically reduces the physiological fear response in the group. The shared burden creates literal, functional safety for one person to experiment with a new purification method without risking everyone's survival.
Right. We can anchor that even further within the paper's own stated application, specifically the clinical medicine section.
Oh, yeah, the hospital triage example.
Yeah. So the text could illustrate how duplicate triage pathways in a hospital directly lower liability fear among the staff.
Mm-hmm.
Picture an emergency room where multiple overlapping assessment teams evaluate incoming trauma.
Right. So the primary nursing staff isn't paralyzed by the sheer liability of making a single fatal error.
Exactly. By explicitly bridging the physical redundancy of the hospital's operations with the emotional shift toward legitimate otherhood, where staff feel safe enough to trust each other, you prove that the safety isn't just a mood, it's a structural output.
Right.
Let's look closely at the section discussing inverse Darwinism. Is there a risk that focusing solely on the structural similarity might overlook the fundamental difference in intent? Genes don't choose to buffer mutations. Humans must actively choose to grant legitimacy. How does the paper account for this leap from passive biological tolerance to active human reflection?
Is the connection between A and B fully established in the material, or is that an area to potentially bolster?
Yeah, exactly.
That represents the precise skeptical boundary the author needs to anticipate from academic readers. To bridge that gap, the text needs to dissect how meaning, or what the author refers to as semiosis, operates across these layers.
Because in biology, it's pretty blunt, right?
Super blunt. The interpretant of a molecular change is just the organism either survives or it dies. There's no reflection involved.
Right.
But in human systems, as the paper points out through Maturana's concept of languaging, we recursively coordinate our actions.
Mm.
Human reflection is what allows a hospital administrator to look at a duplicate triage pathway and consciously decide to lower the institutional defensive posture. The mechanism bridging biological redundancy and sociological love is our capacity to symbolically recognize our own redundancy.
But wait, that creates a completely new problem.
How so?
Well, once we successfully establish how that redundancy creates a beautiful, safe environment for variation, we inevitably have to confront what happens when that safety metastasizes.
Ah, right.
We have to look at an environment that simply refuses to die. That boundary between life coherence and pathological lock-in. The material makes a strong case for constructive neutral evolution by highlighting how redundancy can build incredible new capacities over time.
Yeah.
Dick friction. That leaves the framework vulnerable to subjective retrospective bias.
Which is a profound structural vulnerability for anyone trying to actually use this framework in the real world.
Exactly.
The weakness is that the paper convincingly argues that systems can evolve constructively neutral traits, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these traits can lead to necessary generative divisions of labor, or they can lead to bureaucratic dependency. What the author aptly terms institutional autopoietization.
Yeah, bureaucratic bloat, basically.
Exactly. The danger is that from the inside of an organization, an institution aggressively expanding its bureaucratic procedures almost always views itself as building generative margin.
Right, it thinks it's protecting itself.
Yes, because the framework currently relies on historical, backward-looking evaluation to tell the difference between a healthy system and a parasitic system, it completely lacks a robust, real-time mechanism to differentiate between the two in the present moment.
Right. Imagine a middle manager creating a massive new compliance reporting structure.
Oh, yeah.
In their mind, they're building a vital duplicate pathway to protect the organization. They believe they're doing the work of life coherence.
Totally.
So, to fix this blind spot, the suggestion is to operationalize the life coherence test by introducing leading diagnostic indicators of pathological lock-in.
Moving it from a retrospective philosophical judgment.
Right, where we only realized it was a parasite a decade after it collapses.
To a prospective, actionable tool you can deploy on a random Tuesday.
Exactly. So to make this intensely actionable, the paper needs concrete examples of how to build those real-time indicators.
Like a concrete margin-to-service ratio metric.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. The rule could be framed like this. If the resources required to maintain the so-called generative reserve consistently outpace the resources delivered to the life ground,
the actual people being served.
Right. Over a specific time frame, it signals lock-in. It becomes a mathematical, observable threshold.
Rather than just a subjective feeling of bloat.
Exactly.
And applying that directly to the paper's section on education provides the perfect canvas.
Mm-hmm.
The text should explicitly contrast a school's redundant mentorship pathways, which genuinely build capacity, with redundant compliance reporting, which is pathological lock-in.
Right. Showing how a real-time audit of who actually benefits from the redundancy can diagnose the system's health.
Right. In the mentorship pathway, the learner is gaining capacity. In the compliance pathway, the institution is just preserving its own legal reputation. I can see what you're going for here. Let's see how we can strengthen this. Let's look closely at the section discussing tumor growth as a metaphor for a pathological lock-in. A tumor is highly effective at autopoiesis. If an institution, say a financial regulatory body, is functioning like a tumor by consuming host resources, wouldn't it inherently block the corrigibility the author calls for? How does a system diagnose itself if the diagnostic tools are part of the lock-in?
That makes sense, but could the evidence also support a different conclusion, like the absolute necessity of completely externalized feedback?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. If the internal diagnostic tools, the HR departments, the compliance officers, are compromised by the institution's deeply ingrained self-preservation instinct, the framework might need to mandate third-party, decentralized auditing to survive its own success.
Right, because of structural coupling.
Exactly! The institution is always interacting with its broader environment. If that environment has no independent mechanism to force a diagnosis onto the institution, the bureaucratic lock-in is essentially unbreakable from the inside.
Which leads us directly into the ultimate stress test of the entire framework.
Mm-hmm.
If we are trying to diagnose the health of these complex systems in the real world, we must test the theory against the harshest reality of all. Environments where resources are fundamentally rather than artificially constrained.
Right.
Okay, so what I really like about this part is how thoroughly it dismantles the dominant narrative of artificial scarcity driven by totalizing market forces.
Oh, it's brilliant.
But the critique of the selectionist civilizational myth inadvertently sidesteps the thermodynamic and material realities of acute scarcity, which weakens the framework's persuasiveness for decision makers operating under hard resource constraints.
Yeah, this is where the theoretical framework collides violently with the bedrock of physics.
Yeah, it really does.
The weakness here is that by implicitly treating almost all scarcity as a culturally constructed myth-like, a story designed by capitalists to justify exclusion, the paper fails to address how a system should operate when material margins absolutely necessitate pruning, optimization, and devastatingly hard choices.
Right. We aren't talking about scarcity created by a greedy economic system.
No, we are talking about strict caloric availability, finite ecological carrying capacity, or a sudden catastrophic collapse of resources.
Yeah, when the generative margin physically drops to absolute zero, the framework currently just goes quiet.
Exactly. It essentially leaves the reader wondering if life coherence only works in an era of abundant sunshine and cheap energy.
And if a theory of governance only functions when there is excess capacity to go around, policymakers will dismiss it as utopian poetry the second a crisis hits.
Totally.
So the actionable suggestion to strengthen the robustness of this argument is to explicitly integrate a protocol for life-coherent triage.
Mm-hmm.
Active external realities, proving that the framework holds up, makes hard decisions, and remains ethically sound, even without the luxury of abundance.
Right, let's ground that demand with a concrete example to inject directly into the text.
Okay.
Returning to the clinical medicine application, the author should add a specific scenario detailing a mass casualty event.
Like an earthquake?
Exactly. An earthquake hits the city. The hospital's material reserve, its blood supply, its backup generators are instantly reduced to zero.
Wow. Okay.
There are no duplicate triage pathways left to lower liability fear. How does a life-coherent hospital operate in that specific hour?
Right. The paper must explain how Maturana's biology of love functions during necessary, immediate life and death rationing.
Does legitimate otherhood mean the staff still communicates transparently while making devastating choices about who gets the last ventilator?
Showing exactly how the system behaves under maximum physical compression proves that theory isn't just an academic luxury.
Exactly.
And a second concrete example should be placed in the ecology and environmental governance section, directly addressing the inescapable concept of carrying capacity.
Mm-hmm.
The author needs to show how a life-coherent model manages an ecosystem where a decade-long drought has objectively eliminated the material margin.
Right. Demonstrating that the framework can handle hard limits, like actively calling an invasive population to save a watershed, without reverting to the pathological Darwinism it critiques.
That's clearly laid out. I wonder, though, if we've considered that thermodynamic constraints aren't actually the enemy of generative drift, but rather the ultimate neutral sculptors of it. Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of energy flows?
Okay, how so?
Maintaining any kind of excess capacity requires a continuous, massive energy input. If the physical environment simply cannot provide that energy, the system must shed structure to conserve its core ability to maintain itself.
Right. The paper could frame this reality not as a failure of the generative model, but as a severe, unavoidable phase of structural coupling.
Meaning the universe forces a massive contraction.
Yes. And the life-coherent response, then, is to ensure that the contraction preserves the highest possible density of life capacity and relational trust, rather than simply preserving the highest-ranking bureaucratic structures.
Wow. That reframing completely shifts the paradigm of the entire paper.
It really does.
It shows the reader that life coherence isn't about ignoring physical limits or pretending scarcity doesn't exist. It's about how gracefully, transparently, and equitably a system navigates those limits when they arrive.
Mm-hmm.
Human institutions will always be muddy, complex waters. But by clarifying these underlying mechanisms, establishing boundaries for bloat, and planning for the harshest realities, the mud becomes fertile soil instead of just a disorganized mess.
Beautifully set.
To elevate this incredible transdisciplinary work and make it truly actionable for the leaders who need it most, we've identified three structural pressure tests. First,
map the specific sociological mechanisms that connect biological redundancy to human emotional safety, moving beyond mere analogy.
Second, create real-time diagnostic metrics, like a margin-to-service ratio, to clearly separate generative, life-coherent margins from pathological lock-in before they metastasize.
AGE protocol, to prove the framework survives contact with acute thermodynamic scarcity. We invite you to implement these structural pressure tests and submit the revised material back to the critique for further exploration.